Perhaps Gedan's single best experience will be exploring the shipyard that witnessed the beginning of the end of communism's stranglehold on Eastern Europe. Here in the industrial wasteland that Lech Walesa called the cradle of freedom, this evocative site tells the story of the brave Polish shipyard workers who took on and ultimately defeated an evil empire. A visit to the Solidarity sites has two main parts: the memorial and gate out in front of the shipyard, and the excellent Roads to Freedom exhibit nearby. Both will take about an hour and a half. The memorial and shipyard gate are free and always open. The Roads to Freedom exhibit will be about 6 zloty. The Solidarity Monument and Shipyard are at the north end of town, and I'll reach there via a rather short 20 to 30 minute walk with sights along the way. I'll begin my walk this morning by exiting the hotel and walking directly down to Katska Street. After one long block, on my left, I can see the back of the Armory building. This pearl of the Renaissance architecture recently had a striking facelift, and I'll be able to examine its exquisite decorations. After 3 short blocks, detour to the right and use the side door to enter the brick St. Nicholas Church, the first Catholic church in the city and the only one to escape World War II without a scratch. It was founded by the Dominican Order in 1348 and is in a remarkable church with a dark marbled interior, ancient exposed walls, and a somber atmosphere. There's a multi-level high altar and broke paneled choir stalls, which make it a very popular church for weddings. Archaeologists have found the bodies of 3,000 Napoleonic soldiers buried here. And near the end of World War II, when the Soviet army reached Gdansk on its march westward, they were given the order to burn all of the churches. Only this one, dedicated to Russia's patron saint, was spared. It's the best preserved church in town, especially its lavish black and gold Baroque altars. The church has been entrusted to the Dominicans off and on, pretty much since the first small one was built here in the 1200s. They were forced to leave in the early 1800s, but returned after World War II. With them, they brought a medieval icon of Our Lady of Victory, the patroness of the city, and today I'll find it in the church. I'll backtrack back out of the church into the main street and continue north. Immediately after the church and on the right is Gdansk's newly renovated Market Hall. Look for the coat of arms of Gdansk over each of its 4 doors. It's the 2 white crosses on a red shield. Inside, I'll find mostly local shoppers browsing through produce, other foods, and clothing, as well as the graves of medieval Dominican monks, which were discovered in the basement when the building was renovated. It's a great photo op. I love taking pictures of vegetables. Be sure to look up in order to appreciate the delicate steel and glass canopy. Now that I've had enough of vegetables and perhaps bought my picnic lunch for the day, I'll exit the market hall back toward the main street. And across the street is a round red brick tower. This was once part of the city's protective wall. This marks the end of the main town and the beginning of the old town. Continuing north, another long block up the street, and I'll find the huge St. Catherine's Church, or Katie, as the locals call it. It's the oldest church in Gdansk. In May of 2006, a carelessly discarded cigarette caused the church roof to burst into flames. Local people ran into the church and pulled everything outside so nothing valuable was damaged. Even the carillon bells were saved. However, the roof and wooden frame were totally destroyed. The people of Gdansk were determined to rebuild this important symbol of the city. Within days of the fire, fundraising concerts were held to scrape together most of the money needed to raise the roof once more. If the church is open, it's worth a look in the interior. This 14th century brick church, the former parish church of the old town, and where Helvetius was once church administrator, is also his final resting place. I can find his tomb at the rear behind the altar, along with an epitaph funded by his grandson nearly 100 years after the great man's death. Following the fire, it took a number of years to restore. A fairly Spartan scene, the highlight is a 76-meter Baroque tower housing a 49-bell carillon, which has chimed on the hour every hour since the 50th anniversary of the outbreak of World War II in 1939. The 240-foot tower contains a small museum dedicated to clock towers. There's a little church hiding behind Katie, named for Catherine's daughter, Bridget, and it has very important ties to solidarity and worth a little quick detour to see it. To get there, just continue walking up the street along the side of St. Catherine's Church and past the monument to Pope John Paul II. St. Bridget's Church was the home church of Lech Walesa during the tense days of the 1980s. This church and its priest were particularly aggressive in supporting the ideals of solidarity. The priest, Henrik Jankowski, became a mouthpiece for the movement, and Walesa named his youngest daughter Brigida in gratitude for the church's support. In the back corner, under the wall of wooden crosses, find the tomb of Solidarity martyr Jerzy Popielewski, a famous outspoken Warsaw priest who was kidnapped, beaten, and murdered by the communist secret police. Here, notice that his hands and feet are tied. At the front of the church, check out the enormous, unfinished altar made entirely of amber, featuring the Black Madonna of Częstochowa and a royal Polish eagle. If and when it's finished, it'll be 36 feet high, 20 feet wide, and 10 feet deep. But some locals criticized this ambitious project as an example of Father Jankowski's recent missteps. Despite his fame and contributions to solidarity, Jankowski's public standing has taken a nosedive in the last few years, thanks to ego-driven projects like this, as well as accusations of anti-Semitism and implications of pedophilia and corruption. Because of these issues and because of his worsening health, Jankowski has been forced to retire. I'll backtrack now, past St. Catherine's Church to the main street. Just across from St. Catherine's is a red brick building with a lot of little windows in the roof. This is the Great Mill, which has been converted into a shopping mall. As I turn around and continue north and cross the stream, I'll also see the picturesque small mill straddling the stream on your right. After another block on my right is the modern Madison Shopping Mall. Two blocks to my left are more shopping malls and then the main train station. But my destination is the shipyard. I want to keep heading straight up Rajewska Street. After another long block, I'll jog to the right between the big green glass skyscraper and today's Solidarity headquarters, and head for the three tall crosses. On my way, I'll see signs leading to the Roads to Freedom exhibit. The entrance to this underground museum is actually a freestanding kiosk by the side of the road. But before I visit the museum, I want to head to the shipyard to begin my self-guided tour there. Near the entrance to the museum are two artifacts from communist times. First, parked in front of the museum is an armored personnel carrier, just like the ones used by the ZOMO, or the riot police, to terrorize Polish citizens after martial law was declared in 1981. Nearby, watch for the two big chunks of wall. On the left, a piece of the Berlin Wall, and on the right, a chunk of the shipyard wall Lech Walesa scaled to get inside and lead the strike. The message, what happened behind one wall, eventually led to the fall of the other wall. First, I'll visit the memorial and have a peek into the shipyard before I backtrack to the museum. I want to begin at the towering monument with three anchor-adorned crosses near the entrance gate to the shipyard. Here, let's pause and learn about the history of Solidarity, this shipyard, and Lech Walesa. After the communists took over Eastern Europe at the end of World War II, the oppressed people throughout the Soviet bloc rose up in different ways. The most dramatic uprising, Hungary's 1956 uprising, and Czechoslovakia's 1968 Prague Spring, were both brutally crushed under the treads of Soviet tanks. The formula for freedom that finally succeeded was a patient, decade-long series of strikes spearheaded by Lech Walesa and his trade union called Solidarity. The movement also benefited from good timing, as it coincided with perestroika and glasnost policies of the Soviet premier at the time, Mikhail Gorbachev. While some American politicians might like to take credit for defeating communism, Walesa and his fellow workers were the ones fighting on the line, armed with nothing more than guts. In 1980, the world was turned on its ear by a walrus-mustached shipyard electrician. Within 3 years, this seemingly run-of-the-mill Pole had precipitated the collapse of communism, led a massive 10 million member trade union with enormous political impact, was named Time Magazine's Man of the Year, and won a Nobel Peace Prize. Lech Walesa was born in Popovo, Poland in 1943. After working as a car mechanic and serving 2 years in the army, he became an electrician at the Gdansk shipyard in 1967. Like many Poles, Walesa felt stifled by the communist government and was infuriated that a system that was supposed to be for the workers clearly wasn't serving them. When the shipyard massacre took place in December 1970, Walesa was at the forefront of the protest. He was marked as a dissident, and in 1976 he was fired. He hopped from job to job and was occasionally unemployed under communism, a rock-bottom status reserved for only the most despicable derelicts. But Walesa soldiered on, fighting for the creation of a trade union and building up quite a file with the secret police. In August of 1980, Walesa heard news of the beginnings of the Gdansk strike and raced to the shipyard. In an act that has since become the stuff of legend, Walesa scaled the shipyard wall to get inside. Before long, Walesa's dynamic personality won him the unofficial role of the workers' leader and spokesman. He negotiated with the regime to hash out the August agreements, becoming a rock star type hero during the so-called 16 months of hope, until martial law came crashing down in December of 1981. Walesa was arrested and interned for 11 months in a country house. After being released, he continued to struggle underground, becoming a symbol of anti-communist sentiment. Finally, the dedication of Walesa and Solidarity paid off, and Polish communism dissolved, with Valenza rising from the ashes as the country's first post-communist president. But the skills that made Valenza a rousing success at leading an uprising did not translate to the president's office. Valenza proved to be a stubborn, headstrong politician, frequently clashing with the parliament. He squabbled with his own party, declaring a war at the top of Solidarity and rotating higher-ups to prevent corruption and keep the party fresh. He also didn't choose his advisors well, enlisting several staffers who wound up immersed in scandal. His overconfidence was his Achilles heel, and his governing style verged on authoritarian. Unrefined and none too interested in scripted speeches, Valenza was a simple man who preferred playing ping pong with his buddies to attending formal state functions. Though lacking a formal education, Valenza had unsurpassed drive and charisma, but that's not enough to lead a country, especially during impossibly complicated, fast-changing time when even the savviest politician would certainly have stumbled. Valenza was defeated at the polls, by the polls, in 1995, and when he ran again in 2000, he received a humiliating 1% of the vote. Since leaving office, Valenza has kept a lower profile, but still delivers speeches worldwide. Many poor polls grumble that Lech, who started life simple like them, has forgotten the little people. But his fans point out that he gives much of his income to charity. And on his lapel, he still wears a pin featuring the Black Madonna, the symbol of Polish Catholicism. Polls say there are at least two Lech Valenzas, the young, working-class idealist Lech at the forefront of the Solidarity strikes, who will always have a special place in their hearts, and the failed President Valenza, who got in over his head and tarnished his legacy. I'm standing by the Monument of the Fallen Shipyard Workers. The seeds of August 1980 were sown a decade before. Since becoming part of the Soviet bloc, the Poles staged frequent strikes, protests, and uprising to secure the rights, all of which were put down by the regime. But the bloodiest of these took place in December 1970, a tragic event memorialized by this monument. The 1970 strike was prompted by price hikes. The communist government set the prices for all products. As Poland endured drastic food shortages in the 60s and 70s, the regime frequently announced what it called regulation of prices. Invariably, this meant an increase in the cost of essential foodstuffs. To be able to claim regulation rather than increase, the regime would symbolically lower prices for a few select items, but these were always non-essential luxuries, such as elevators and TV sets, which nobody could afford anyway. The regime was usually smart enough to raise prices on January 1st, when the people were fat and happy after Christmas and too hungover to complain. But on December 12th, 1970, bolstered by an ego-stroking visit by West German Chancellor Willy Brandt, Polish Premier Władysław Gromułka increased prices. The people of Poland, who cared more about the price of Christmas dinner than relations with Germany, struck back. A wave of strikes and sit-ins spread along the heavily industrialized north coast of Poland, most notably in Gdansk, Gdynia, and Szczecin. Thousands of angry demonstrators poured through the gate of the shipyard, marched into town, and set fire to the Communist Party committee building. In attempt to quell the riots, government-run radio implored the people to go back to work. On the morning of December 17th, workers showed up at shipyard gates across northern Poland and were greeted by the army and police. Without provocation, the Polish army opened fire on the workers. While the official death toll for the massacre stands at 44, Others say the true number is much higher. This monument, with the trio of 140-foot-tall crosses, honors those lost to the regime that December. From here, walk to the middle of the wall behind the crosses to the monument of the worker wearing a flimsy plastic work helmet, attempting to shield himself from bullets. Behind him is a list, pockmarked with symbolic bullet holes, of workers murdered on that day. Lacked means years old. Many teenagers were among the dead. The quote at the top of the wall is from Pope John Paul II, who was elected 8 years after this tragedy. The Pope was known for his clever way with words, and this very carefully phrased quote, which served as an inspiration to the Poles during their darkest hours, skewers the regime in a way subtle enough to still be tolerated. Quote, "Let thy spirit descend and renew the face of the earth, this earth," unquote. The Pope was speaking of Poland. Below that is the dedication. They gave their lives so you can live decently. Stretching to the left of this center wall are plaques representing labor unions from around Poland and around the world, including some in Chinese characters, all expressing solidarity with these workers. To the right is an enormous Bible verse. May the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with the gift of peace. More than a decade after the massacre, this monument was finally constructed. It marked the first time a communist regime ever allowed a monument to be built to honor its own victims. Valenza called it a harpoon in the heart of the communists. Inspired by the brave sacrifice of their true comrades, the shipyard workers rose up here in August of 1980, formulating the 21 points of a new union called Solidarity. The demands included the right to strike and form unions, the freeing of political prisoners, and an increase in wages. These 21 points are listed in Polish on the panel at the far end of the right wall, marked 21 ex tak solidosa, 21 times yes, solidarity. From here, I can continue to the gate and peer through into the birthplace of Eastern European freedom, the Gdansk Shipyard, Gate 2. When a Pole named Karol Wojtyla was elected Pope in 1978 and visited his homeland in 1979, he inspired his 40 million countrymen to believe that impossible dreams can come true. Prices continued to go up, and the workers continued to rise up. By the summer of 1980, it was clear that the dam was about to break. In August, Anna Walentolewicz, a Gdansk crane operator and known dissident, was fired unceremoniously just short of her retirement. This sparked a strike in the Gdansk shipyard, then called the Lenin shipyard, on August 14, 1980. An electrician named Lech Walesa had been fired as an agitator years before and wasn't allowed into the shipyard. But on hearing news of the strike, Walesa went to the shipyard and climbed over the wall to get inside. The strike now had a leader. Imagine being one of the 16,000 workers who stayed here for 18 days during the strike. Hungry, cold, sleeping on sheets of styrofoam, inspired by the new Polish Pope, excited about finally standing up to the regime, and terrified that they might be gunned down at any moment, like your friends had been a decade before. Because you're afraid to leave the shipyard, your only way to communicate with the outside world is through this gate. Your wife or brother shows up here and asks for you. and those inside spread the word until you come talk to them. Occasionally, a truck pulls up to the gate, and Lech Walesa stands on his cab with a megaphone and faces the thousands of people assembled outside the gate, giving them progress reports of the negotiations and pleading for supplies. The people of Gdansk respond, bringing armfuls of bread and other food, keeping the workers going. This truly is solidarity. During the strike, two items hung on the fence. One of them, which still hangs there today, was a picture of Pope John Paul II, a reminder to believe in your dreams and have faith in God. The other item was a makeshift list of the strikers' 21 points, demands scrawled in red paint and black pencil on pieces of plywood. Today, this part of the shipyard, long abandoned, is gradually being redeveloped into a young city, envisioned as a new city center for Gdansk with shopping, restaurants, and homes. Rusting shipbuilding equipment will be torn down and old brick buildings will be converted into gentrified flats. Just behind the monument will be the new European Center of Solidarity, still an active union in many countries. The shipyard gate, monument, and other important sites from the Solidarity strikes will stay put. The ambitious project isn't due to be completed until about 2030. I can walk to the right and peer through the gate. The path leading into the shipyard, which is likely closed to visitors, passes through two large symbolic gateways. The first resembles the rusted hull of a ship, representing the protest of the shipbuilders. The new gateway, a futuristic, colorful tower, is a small-scale version of a 1,000-foot-tall monument planned by the prominent Soviet constructionist architect Vladimir Tatlin. This fanciful but unfulfilled design represents the misguided, failed optimism of the communist utopia. In the distance, squint to see the low-profile red brick building. This is the BHP conference hall, where the communists actually sat down across the table from Lech Walesa and worked out a compromise. This building is being restored and will be a centerpiece of the Roads to Freedom exhibit when it moves back here in several years. To learn the rest of the history of this historic area, I'll need to return about 100 yards back toward the main town. With the main shipyard gate to my back, I'll walk straight ahead, passing the green and yellow building on my right. I'll cross the street and walk toward the green skyscraper. After about a block, I can see stairs leading underground into the Roads to Freedom exhibit. At the museum entrance, walk downstairs amid the angry shouts from the Zomo and buy my ticket, which is designated to look like the communist rations coupons that all Poles had to carry and present before they could buy certain goods. Cashiers would stand with scissors at the ready, prepared to snip off a corner of your coupon after making the sale. Consider picking up a solidarity book or other souvenir at the excellent gift shop here before moving on. To the right of the ticket desk are some depressing reminders of the communist days. The phone book is marked Automat Nasilnye, or out of order, as virtually all phone booths were back then. In the humble, authentic commie water closet, notice that instead of toilet paper, there's a wad of old newspapers. Actually, toilet paper was cause for celebration. Notice the mannequin with several rolls on a string around her neck. Across from the ticket desk is a typical Polish shop marked Swatzum, a truncated version of for grocery store. It's from the 1970s and during the worst of the food shortages. Great selection? No. Often the only things in stock were vinegar and mustard. Milk and bread were generally available, but they were low quality. It wasn't unusual to find a cigarette butt in your loaf. The few blocks of cheese and other items in the case weren't real. They were props placed there so the shop wouldn't look completely empty. Sometimes they'd hang a few pitiful, phony salamis from the hooks. Otherwise, people might think it was a tile shop. The only real meat in here were the flies on the flypaper. Despite the meager supplies, shoppers, mostly women, would sometimes have to wait in line literally all day long just to pick over these scant choices. People didn't necessarily buy what they needed. Instead, they'd buy anything that could be bartered on the black market. On the counter, notice the little jar holding clipped-off ration coupons. Continuing into the exhibit, the first room explains the roots of the shipyard strikes, including the famous uprising in Hungary and Czechoslovakia, and the December 1970 riots in Poland. An interactive computer screen can tell me more about these events. The prison cell is a reminder of Stalin's strong-arm tactics for getting the people of Eastern Europe to sign on to his new regime. Then head into the heart of the exhibit, August 1980. Near the plaster statue of Lenin are several tables. These were the actual tables used in the red brick building back in the shipyard when the communist authorities finally agreed to negotiate after 18 days of protest. On the afternoon of August 31st, 1980, the governmental commission and the inter-factory strike committee came together and signed the August agreements, which legalized solidarity. The first time any communist government permitted a workers' union. Photos and a video show the giddy day as the Polish Bob Dylan laments the evils of the regime. Lech Walesa, sitting at the big table with his characteristic walrus mustache, signed the agreement with a big, red, souvenir-type pen adorned with the picture of Pope John Paul II, which is displayed across the room. Other union reps sitting at smaller tables tape-recorded the proceedings and played them later at their own factories, to prove that the unthinkable had happened. Near the end of this room are replicas of the plywood boards featuring the 21 points which hung on the front gate. While the government didn't take the agreements very seriously, the Poles did. And before long, 10 million of them, one out of every four Poles, joined Solidarity. So began the 16 months of hope. The theme of the next room. Newly legal, Solidarity continued to stage strikes and make its opposition known. Slick Solidarity posters and children's art conveyed the childlike enthusiasm with which the Poles seized their hard-won kernels of freedom. The poster with a baby in a Solidarity t-shirt, 1 year old, just like the Union itself, captures the sense of hope. The communist authorities' hold on the Polish people began to slip. The rest of the Soviet bloc looked on nervously, and the Warsaw Pact army assembled at the Polish border and glared at the uprisers. The threat of invasion hung heavy in the air. Turn the corner to see Solidarity's progress come crashing down. On Sunday morning, December 13, 1981, the Polish head of state, General Jaruzelski, appeared on national TV and announced the introduction of martial law. Solidarity was outlawed and its leaders were arrested. Frightened Poles heard the announcement and looked out their windows to see Polish army tanks rumbling through the snowy streets. Jaruzelski claimed that he imposed martial law to prevent the Soviets from invading. Today, many historians question whether martial law was really necessary, though Jaruzelski remains remorseless. Martial law was a tragic, terrifying, and bleak time for the Polish people. It didn't, however, kill the Solidarity movement, which continued its fight after going underground. Notice that the movement's martial law era propaganda was produced with far more primitive printing equipment than the earlier posters. In the next room, I can see a clandestine print shop like those used to create that illegal propaganda. Surrounding the room are sobering displays of Zomo riot gear. A film reveals the ugliness of martial law. Watch the footage of General Jaruzelski wearing his trademark dark glasses, reading the announcement of martial law. Chilling scenes show riots, demonstrations, and crackdowns by the Zomo, including one demonstrator who's run over by a truck. An old woman is stampeded by a pack of fleeing demonstrators. The next room shows a film tracing the whole history of communism in Poland with a copy of Lech Walesa's Nobel Peace Prize. For a happy ending, head into the final room with an uplifting film about the fall of the Iron Curtain across Eastern Europe, right up through 2004's Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. Here's how it happened in Poland. By the time the Pope visited his homeland again in 1983, martial law had finally been lifted and Solidarity, still technically illegal, was gaining momentum, gradually pecking away at the communists. With the moral support of the Pope and the entire Western world, the brave Poles were the first European country to throw off the shackles of communism when, in the spring of 1989, the round table talks led to the opening of elections. The government arrogantly called for parliamentary elections, reserving 65% of seats for themselves. The plan backfired as virtually every open seat went to Solidarity. This success inspired people all over Eastern Europe. And by that winter, the Berlin Wall had crumbled and the Czechs and Slovaks had staged their Velvet Revolution. Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia with this singing revolution were to follow in 1991. But in Poland, Lech Walesa, the shipyard electrician who started it all by jumping over a wall, became the first president of the post-communist Poland. After a year in Poland's first true election since World War II, 29 different parties won seats in the parliament. This celebration of democracy was brought to the Polish people by a brave electrician and the workers of Gdańsk. This completes the walking tour. I can retrace my steps back toward St. Bridget, and from there meander the few blocks to the river, and there possibly find a boat that will take me out to Westerplatte, where World War II began.